So yes, we've been exploring themes from this book, Not About Being Good, and I'm going to continue doing that, but I'm going to take a slightly different tack this evening. And it was Subhadramati's idea, actually, that I talk about this figure that we've got on the shrine, this figure of Vajrasattva, and in doing so, I'll introduce some of the themes that are in this book that I want to talk about. This figure of Vajrasattva, he's an archetypal Buddha, which means that he exists, as it were, in a realm that isn't historical, it's mythical. He's a mythical, symbolic figure, personifying a dimension of reality that is, in a way, as I was saying in the announcement, more true, more real than the usual everyday experience of the world that we have. So in a sense, when I say that Vajrasattva is a mythical figure, a symbolic figure, that isn't to, I don't want you to think, oh, he's a fantasy figure, if you see what I mean. That therefore he's just unreal. In a certain sense, Vajrasattva, or at least what he symbolizes, is more real. He's actually a symbol for reality itself, in its most deepest and most profound aspect. He's a figure that comes from the tantric tradition, from the Vajrayana, as it's called. So it's late Buddhism. It's a tradition, the Tibetan Tantra, which particularly uses symbols to evoke the energies of the mind and the body, to wake us up to the nature of the true nature of things. And I'll say a little bit about what Vajrasattva's appearance is. The image that you've got is obviously an artist's impression of a traditional kind of figure, and it's not a particularly traditional form. The first thing to say about these figures is that they're imaginative figures that you contact in meditation. And when you contact them in meditation, if you imagine them, they appear in a vast blue sky. The sky is sometimes used as an image for the true nature of the mind. A vast, clear blue sky that's infinite in all directions. It's not just the sky above you, it's a sky that is all around you, in every direction, limitless, open, expansive, scintillatingly clear. And that's an image for the nature of consciousness, for the nature of mind. And Vajrasattva appears in that sky, diaphanous. He's made of light, and he sits on a lotus throne, a white lotus that's also made of light. And on the lotus there's a moon mat, like the full moon, a disc of light, like the moon mat, like the moon, that's also white. And then he sits on this, and he is also radiantly white. So there's this image of a form that's glittering with dazzling whiteness. It's said to be not just an ordinary white, it's said to be the white that is like sunlight falling on snow. Sunlight on snow, and the dazzling nature of that, the glittering nature of that. Vajrasattva has that, his body is made of that glittering nature. He's surrounded by rainbow light. So it's as if this dazzling whiteness is almost too much to behold, too much to gaze on directly. It would be blinding, it would be shattering. And the rainbows that he's surrounded with enable us to approach him, enable us to approach him. And He's also clothed in beautiful jewels and silks of a bodhisattva, of a prince, really. He wears this crown of jewels, and in one of his hands, in his left hand, he's holding a vajra, which is a symbol. Well, it's a symbol for the shattering kind of nature of reality that cuts through all delusion. It's a diamond thunderbolt. So he's holding a force of nature to his heart, and it's the most powerful object, or it represents the most powerful force in reality, this diamond thunderbolt that shatters through all delusion. It cuts through all of our ignorance about who we are and what the world is. He holds that very lightly to his heart. It's derived from the pre-Buddhist tradition, probably pre-sort of Hindu tradition. It was a sort of thunderbolt. It was I guess in Western classical tradition, it would be like the thunderbolt of Zeus. The Vajra has that sort of connotation. And then in his right hand, held to his hip, he's holding a silver bell, which also has a Vajra handle, this silver bell. And together, the bell and the thunderbolt, the Vajra, become associated as symbols for wisdom and compassion. So the bell is wisdom, and the Vajra is this energy of compassion that's engaging with the world. And Vajrasattva is said to be the primeval Buddha. He's the Buddha outside of space and time. He's our essential nature. He's reality. He's the first form. So out of this blue sky, where there's no form, the nature of mind is completely pure and empty, and there's no way of grasping it in any substantial form at all, even conceptually. Out of that, the first form that, as it were, appears is Vajrasattva. He's that ultimate purity of mind personified. And yes, he's particularly associated with purity of mind, which then links him to ethics. When in our tradition, in the Triratna Buddhist order, when somebody is ordained, if they want to, they can take up a visualization practice of a Buddha or Bodhisattva that symbolizes enlightenment in some dimension, in some aspect. And in visualizing that figure, you form a relationship with the figure, and through the figure with the ideal of enlightenment. And that relationship changes you. And when I was ordained, I was given the visualization practice of Vajrasattva. I was asked by my preceptor, Subhuti, just a few days before ordination, what figure I particularly wanted to meditate upon, what figure I felt a connection with. And I wasn't completely sure, but I said, rather tentatively, Vajrasattva is probably what I feel, who I feel a resonance with. And he said, oh yes, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And just him affirming that hesitant tentative approach from me gave me confidence. It made me feel it was right. I asked him why it was right, and he said, well, you, me that is, want to go to the heart of things. You really want to see the heart of things in any situation. And he said, Vajrasattva is the heart of things. He is the ultimate truth. He's the heart of things. And I said, Well, that's great. I do want to do that. But I'm not interested in purity. The whole notion of purity just feels completely off-putting, or it did at the time. It had connotations of weakness, of meekness. Even the colour white felt milky white rather than this dazzling white that was too much to look at. In the Christian tradition, I was born in the Hindu, in a Hindu family, so I've never been particularly influenced by Christianity, at least not directly, but you know, living in the West, you are exposed to Christian images and ideals, and purity is associated, I guess, with the Virgin Mary, the very fact that it's virginity that is associated with purity felt completely off-putting to me. I wasn't interested in trying to be a celibate monk. It was too late to be a virgin, but I wasn't, you know, wasn't moving in that direction anyway, as it were. So this whole notion of sex as being somehow sinful and purity as being the opposite of that, you know, that sort of that just felt completely off-putting. And then even just sort of ethical purity, for me, didn't feel at the time particularly exciting. I wanted enlightenment. I didn't want to be good. Subhadramati's book, not about being good, I think gets to the heart of it. And Subhuti said something very, very important to me. What he said was, he just looked at me and said, well, Vajrasattva's got nothing to do with purity. He's not about purity. And that was a little thunderbolt. It was a teaching in itself. It was like a little Vajra thunderbolt that went in, because Vajrasattva is associated with purity. And I'd read my Buddhism. I'd studied my basic tantric Buddhism stuff, and I knew that Vajrasattva was associated with purity. And so my teacher, my preceptor, saying to me, Vajrasattva is nothing to do with purity, was like one of these Zen koans, although it felt more like a thunderbolt. And I immediately knew what he meant. I could have said, what do you mean? But in my heart, I knew. I knew that what he meant. What he meant was... And what he meant was that he's not to do with piety in the sense that we might associate ethics with. And the word purity can feel like it's to do with piety and virginity and being meek and weak. Vajrasattva's got nothing to do with that. In a certain sense, he's got nothing to do with ethical purity either. But I'll come back to that, because that's not completely true. What Vajrasattva's purity is about is about this blue sky, this nature of mind that is completely open and completely empty of any conceptual way of thinking about it. It's said to be beyond space and time and subject and object and any conceptual formula that we can put on it. And yet it's said to be our own true nature. Our deepest nature of consciousness is like that. It's somehow outside of the realm of samsaric existence, with all our notions of not just even of good and bad, but in Buddhist terms of skillful and unskillful. It's outside of all of that. In the first half, I was reading this poem by Rumi, and he said, outside of all notions of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field, I'll meet you there. And Vajrasattva is that field outside of any notion of ethics, at least in terms of skillfulness and unskillfulness. What's been got at is that our deepest nature is always unsullied. It's like the sky can never be sullied. You can never make that blue sky impure. What you can do is cover it over. Clouds can cover it over. The mind can be covered over. That purity of mind can be covered over by clouds. But the mind remains untouched. The consciousness behind the clouds remains completely pure and untouched. It's pristine all the time. It's this pristine whiteness all the time. The clouds mask it. And ordinarily, that's how we live our lives. We live our lives under clouds. All of our everyday consciousness is it's clouded. It's clouding the true nature of who we are and what our experience is. So the Dharma, the whole of the Buddhist path, can be thought of as just removing the clouds to reveal what's already there. And when you do that, when you glimpse what's there, you glimpse Vajrasattva, and you glimpse him not as some sort of Tibetan tantric figure that is outside of you. You glimpse him as your own true nature. You glimpse him in actual experience as mind itself. And of course, when that happens, he won't be sitting on a lotus. He won't be necessarily jeweled, and he won't even appear necessarily as a figure. Nevertheless, his essence will be experienced as your essence of mind. The path of Buddhism, then, if you think of it as about removing these obscurations, removing these coverings that cloud the mind, that path begins with ethics. It begins with us learning to be more skillful. Because every time that we act unskillfully, we cloud the mind a bit further. We cloud the mind a bit further. We reinforce the basic ignorance of having a separate, fixed, and separate self. Every time we act unskillfully, that sense of identity of me versus the world solidifies a little bit more. It's as if the clouds thicken a little bit more. And if it's really, really unskillful, it's like the clouds not just thicken, they darken. We live then in a darker mind that is also feels more constrained, it feels smaller, it feels like we're hemmed in, we're imprisoned by our own mind. Unethical behaviour tends to narrow and darken and make the mind more like a prison, actually. It solidifies things. And then the purity that is our own nature, our true nature, is more obscured. It's harder to access, it's harder to see, it's harder to believe. So the path begins with ethics, where we learn how to act more skillfully and start to create a more expansive, joyous, fulfilled, creative state of mind. But even that doesn't get us to Vajrasattva. You can be very, very skillful in your life. You can be very, very ethical. Lots of people wouldn't consider themselves Buddhist at all. I'm sure there are lots of people who aren't Buddhist who are much kinder than I am, less self-centered than I am. And that doesn't still get you to glimpse the true nature of mind. The path begins with ethics, and actually in a certain sense it ends with ethics. But in the middle, you also have to purify the mind through meditation, and then you also have to reflect on the true nature of mind to try and remove the delusions. The delusions go really, really deep. This fundamental delusion that there's a real me in a real objectively existent world out there is so deep that it's the sort of delusion of our lives. It's life itself is that delusion. Life as we experience it is an embodiment of that delusion. So it's not something that you just eradicate like that. You have to see through the delusion. You have to break through the delusion. And you can't do that without... it's very, very difficult to do that without some sort of meditative experience. Because what meditation does is it takes a skillful consciousness and then makes it brighter and more expansive and more creative and malleable and responsive. It starts to create this sense of connection with others, this empathy that I was talking about when we first came in, this sense of resonance with the life in others. And what that does is it breaks down, it starts to then break down the barriers that we put within between ourselves and the world and other people. It starts to loosen those barriers. And then on the basis of a mind that is, Maitra Bandhu calls it a fit mind. On the basis of a fit mind, you start to reflect on the fundamental delusion. You try and reflect on the nature of reality. I'm not going to go into how you do that, but what's said to happen is that sometimes those reflections become more than just thought. Something opens up and you can have a direct experience, a direct seeing, a knowing, a feeling of this vast consciousness. This vast consciousness that has no identity. You can't call it mine, because the whole notion of me is the delusion that prevents you seeing it. Me and mine. It's not me and mine. Therefore, it's not, as it were, separate from you or the rest of the world. It's not a personal identity. It's not an identity at all. It's what arises in experience when all ways of identifying are left behind. And you can glimpse that in actual experience. It's a bit like the clouds just part for perhaps just a moment. And you intuit imaginatively and directly, you intuit the vastness behind our ordinary clouded world. And what the path says, what Buddhism says, is that those glimpses can arise more and more often. They can arise more and more often. The clouds will come back. It's not that egotism and the delusion is just dispelled in one instant. I guess theoretically it could be, but in practice the clouds come back. The clouds come back. But once there's this chink in the clouds, once you've seen it for what it is, even just once, you're never completely convinced by the clouds again. Do you see what I mean? You know that behind the clouds there's a deeper reality, a truer reality. So the clouds can't fool you. And then that conviction becomes more fuel for the path. And then you really are going to be working on doing everything you can to eliminate the delusion, to work on purifying the heart, the mind, so that you can get back to who you always were, to our birthright, to consciousness in that unsullied, pristine state. But even that's not the end of the path, because in a certain sense, so what? So what that you or I might experience ourselves in that vastness, in that vast way. I mean, beautiful, but But it's not enough, because from a Buddhist perspective, that's still potentially self-centered. It can potentially still be sort of appropriated by the ego identity, so that what can easily then happen is that it bolsters my sense of me or your sense of you, and now we think we're even better than we were because we're in touch with the vastness. so that doesn't help at all. What the point of the Dharma is that through getting out of the way, through getting the clouds out of the way, the sun can shine through. And this force, a force can shine through your being that is a force of compassion. It's a force that wants to, that wills good in the world, that resonates with all life in a way that ordinarily I can't. It's a force that works through us, and we become, as it were, embodiments of that force for good in the world. And even that's not enough, because on our own, a single person can't do very much. So what in Triratna we're trying to do is form a sangha of individuals who are opening up to this force. And then collectively, we can do more. We can try and be a force for good in the world in this life. And that feels to me like an ideal that is really worth striving for, because the world desperately needs that. Yeah, the world desperately needs that. It needs people who are acting as forces, as agents of kindness, of love, of goodness, of truth, but not just from the fact that they're a good person, but from real wisdom which is seen through the delusion of separateness altogether. Yeah. Then something more comes through. And Vajrasattva represents that force. He represents wisdom and compassion acting through us, or potentially acting through us. He's our true potential, our true nature. Now that way of thinking, that Buddhist notion that actually we are already, if we could only but see it, we're already beyond all impurity. That even the notion of purity, we're beyond that. The notion of unskillfulness and skillfulness, we're beyond that. There's nothing that can really pollute the mind. It can be covered over, but it can't be sullied. That notion is a very, very positive notion of our true nature. It's very different from a notion that we're born sinful, yeah? And that then we've got to work at being good so that we can be purified. It's almost the other way around, that we're born pure, and then we've covered that over through our own ignorance. A very, very positive notion. Other Buddhist schools do have different notions of this, because you could also say that the ignorance that we've got goes very, very deep, and we're born with that. But certainly from the perspective of Vajrasattva, the purity is deeper than even the ignorance. Yeah. So otherwise, enlightenment wouldn't be possible. Otherwise, enlightenment wouldn't be possible. So then that puts a very different flavour, gives a very different flavour to Buddhist ethics. It's not then concerned, Buddhist ethics isn't concerned with somehow purifying ourselves from sin or atoning for sin. It's not really concerned with sin at all. It's not concerned with guilt. So Subhadramati makes this point very well in her book, that Buddhism has no truck with guilt. Guilt is differentiated in Buddhism from remorse. And I'm going to try and unpack the difference Akashamitra said a little bit about it, I think, last week, although I wasn't here last week. Some of you might have heard what he had to say. But guilt is differentiated from remorse. Guilt itself is seen as an unskillful mental state, something that clouds the mind and needs to be got rid of, seen through. So I'm going to open it up to you and see if if some of you might be able to say, in what sense is guilt unskillful? Why would guilt be unskillful? And by analysing or looking at why guilt is unskillful, we might be able to uncover what I mean by remorse, which is skillful, is highly skillful, but can be confused with guilt. So in what sense is guilt unskillful, do you think? Yes, go on.
I think it's based on an emotion that comes from dwelling on the past, so it takes you out of the present moment.
Right. And why would that be unskillful, to dwell on the past?
Because you can't change it.
Ah. So you can't change it. But can you not learn from it?
Yes. But I don't think the emotion of guilt is really a learning process.
Ah. Well, that's closer. So why do you think it's not a learning process?
Because it's too heavy. It like has too much of a charge.
Yes.
Of kind of fixedness.
Yes.
You can't grow with guilt.
Yes. Yes. It's a bit like with guilt, what can come, perhaps subconsciously, perhaps more consciously, is a notion that I'm bad. I'm bad. I'm a bad person. Sometimes one isn't even clear about in what way is one bad. You just have this sense that there's something deeply wrong and that I'm bad. I'll come back to you too. So out of that sense of being bad, well, as you say, it's heavy. All we've done is solidify another identity, and a not very positive one, of I'm bad. So there's a heaviness to guilt that can become solid. Yeah, so that's good. This thing about it being about the past is also interesting, because I think you're right that we can start to hang on to the past in an unhelpful way and define ourselves by past behaviours. So just because I did something unskillful a few years ago, that doesn't mean that that needs to define me now. In the Sangha, we've got lots of people who have got quite dodgy pasts. And many of them now, I won't name names, at least not while I'm on camera, many of them now are order members teaching the Dharma, but they have been pretty dodgy characters in the past. If we were to define ourselves by the past and think that we can't change, and if guilt is contributing to that thing that I can't change, then that's really unhelpful. That's really unhelpful. Yeah. So, yes, you in the red.
Oh, me?
Yes.
My point was sort of, you
essentially said it. Oh, I've said it, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I suppose it's covered. promotes self-hatred.
Right. Yes. It promotes self-hatred and gets in the way of metta. If I feel that I'm a bad person, I'm unlikely to be able to feel self-metta, and I'm unlikely to be able to really relate from metta to others if there's at core a sense that I'm bad. So I think it becomes the antithesis of... it becomes an obstacle, to cultivating metta. Somebody else had a point. I've forgotten whose hand it was.
Just yes. Me, but you kind of said...
I've said it all.
The way I was going to phrase it was that fear is empowering.
Disempowering, yeah, it's disempowering, that's right. Why is it disempowering, do you think?
Because if I'm a bad person, then I'm not good enough to create change.
Ah, yes, right. So then I can't change. I can't change myself and I can't change the world around me.
Yeah, it's even the language. It's all about you being unable to do something as opposed to you being able to do something. Or shame or remorse.
Yeah.
You cannot see shame and you cannot see remorse outside the light of what is the good way of doing things.
Ah, yes.
Whereas you can have guilt outside the right way of doing things. Because the nature of guilt is all about the bad.
Yes. So I'll come back to shame and remorse, but I think you're absolutely right that shame and remorse are always in relationship to the ideal that you can become. And a way of thinking about them is that we've just clouded us, we've created a cloud that blocks temporarily us from seeing the ideal. But guilt is associated with fear. Guilt and fear can go very closely together. A fear that you'll be punished somehow. Now, if you are part of a theistic tradition, that punishment would come from God. Would come from God. So in a theistic tradition, part of God's role would be to punish sin. And then guilt becomes associated with that fear of being punished. In Buddhism, there's no authority figure, there's no creator God. There's nobody judging you or me, thankfully. We're free from that oppression of judgment and of punishment and of reward, actually. So the whole notion of guilt doesn't quite make sense without the notion of an authority that can punish. I'll go there and I'll come back to you, Doria. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of, I'm struggling with something in my head, and it's about a sense of like communal justice and culpability. So where does that come into the conversation? So I've, let's say, committed an act that has done harm to a fellow human being in a community, and what is, how is that related to this?
So how would you think that it should be related?
I guess as perhaps it's a nuance of the meaning of guilt that I'm not connecting to. So
sure.
I guess guilt for me can have two senses of the word. So culpability and remorse are two ways I would understand guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, how does Buddhism reconcile, my question is, how does Buddhism reconcile the notion of culpability, having committed something, and a sense of justice then in a community?
Mm.
Does that
Yeah, it does. I may not...
Is that too tangential?
It might take us off to another direction. I may come back to that. But what you do say is interesting, that the word guilt is often used in terms of somebody is guilty, and then they're guilty of a crime, and then the whole notion of justice comes to bear. I'm using it more as a mental state rather than as
a feeling, emotion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So we'll come back to maybe that sort of justice element, but it's a slightly different topic. But as a mental state, it's a feeling of a sense of being guilty or feeling guilty. That's what I'm trying to explore. Yeah. And what I'm trying to say is that we need to differentiate a sort of healthy sense of remorse from an unhealthy sense of feeling guilty. Yeah. And it's a subtle distinction. And I'll come on to perhaps what remorse looks like, and then that'll help make that distinction. But just see if Idoya's got a comment before.
Yes, when you were talking about fear or guilt coming with fear, and I was thinking of other Buddhist traditions where people might think that their karma and their actions, then it will have a consequence either in this life or in the following life, and they'll have a better or worse rebirth, and whether they will act out of fear as well.
Okay. Well, let me just touch on that, and that might touch on this sense that you were asking about. Well, it does and it doesn't. So what Buddhism does say is that, yes, there's no authority, there's no God. And even the Buddha, or Vajrasattva, doesn't act as an authority, punishing or rewarding. Sense that you'll have to, that you'll be judged in that way by your actions. The Buddhas don't do that. Nevertheless, the law of karma teaches that if we act unskillfully, that is likely to lead to suffering, both for ourselves and probably for others. And the converse, that if we act skillfully from kindness, generosity, awareness, that's likely to lead to more meaning and fulfillment in our lives and freedom in our lives, and be beneficial for others. Now, that law of karma is seen as a natural law that operates in the universe, not unlike the laws that science recognizes. It's an ethical law that is like a natural law in the universe. It's not operated by a creator God who's judging and saying, Jnanavacha's been bad-tempered, therefore let's punish him with what did I be punished with? No cake for a week or something like that. It's not like that. The law of karma seems to be more like a law that is a natural law of consciousness. So, I was saying that when I act unskillfully, my consciousness, my mind, becomes more narrow and darker and less flexible. That is already the law of karma in operation. I'm experiencing a contracted, more painful state of mind as a result of, say, I got angry. Immediately the mind feels tighter. It feels clenched. The body feels tighter and clenched. There's this sort of obsessive narrowing of thought. I can't think more broadly. There's not a creative kind of solution. I'm cut off from other people. I'm sort of locked into my righteous anger, even if there's some sort of justification. I'm cut off. That itself is suffering. That's the law of karma instantly manifesting in my mind. So there are consequences to our actions for ourselves and for the world around us. Buddhism isn't saying that we act without any consequence. In fact, it's saying quite the opposite. Every action will have consequences. What we're trying to do is learn how to be more intelligent with our actions, more skillful with our actions, so that we experience this expansion of mind. So from a Buddhist perspective, if somebody is unskillful, they are already suffering, and they may continue to suffer in other kind of ways in the future. But unskillful states of mind create that suffering. So I don't need to be a judge on somebody else's behaviour and impose some sort of punishment. Now, that's quite different from looking at how society works, and I appreciate that when you're dealing with communities and societies, there are all sorts of other factors that come into place. But at a purely existential level and psychological level, that person is already suffering if they've committed unskillful acts. What Buddhism's teaching us is to take responsibility for our actions and the consequences of our actions. It's saying only by taking responsibility can we start to change. One of the things with guilt is is it can absolve us from taking responsibility. We feel bad and we think that we might be punished, but we don't really take responsibility. Yeah, we're still acting in a sort of literal rule-bound way. Somebody has told us that to swear in public is bad, and then we're frightened. It's like a little infantile kind of response, you know, in relation to some sort of parental authority figure. God becomes this big parental authority figure, and I remain a child in relation to that. So that means that we don't fully take responsibility for our behaviour. A mature human being, let alone somebody trying to become enlightened, a mature human being takes responsibility for their actions. Buddhism goes further than some traditions, because it says that even our conscious thoughts, our volitions, our volitional impulses, are actions. Yeah. So when you do the metta bhavana and you wish somebody well, that is positive karma. That will have a positive effect on your mind and maybe on the world around you. Conversely, if I wish somebody suffering, if I was in a state of resentment, anger, hatred, and wished suffering for somebody, that is negative karma for myself. That's unskillful karma for myself. So our thoughts, our volitions, our conscious thoughts, and our words, our speech, as well as our actual behaviour, is all action in Buddhism. It's all karma, and it all has an effect. Yeah, it always has consequences. So Subhadramati in this book is teaching us how to be more intelligent about our actions at all three levels of thought, of speech, and of bodily actions, physical actions. That's what Buddhist ethics is based on. So it is based on this law of karma. Yeah? Actions having consequences, yes.
You're the subject of bad treatment.
Yes, what if somebody has treated us badly?
Yeah.
Yes.
What's the right response?
So what would you say would be a skillful response in that scenario?
You've got to preserve your self-love in that situation, that you're not to go down a spiral of self-damage.
Yes. That's right. That's one aspect of it.
Beyond that, that's the
rest of you. Sure. So let's see. So put your hand up if you have felt that you have ever in your life been hurt unfairly by or badly treated. Yeah. Now, of course, that varies, doesn't it? That varies from people who have been victims of torture and horrendous treatment to somebody pushing their way in front of you on the tube or something like that. There's a whole spectrum, isn't there, of ill treatment. So let's just open it up a bit before I answer. I think it's a really good question.
Another thing to add, because sometimes the natural response, you know, if you're in a situation, you know, anger might be an individual response to that, so, and that's unskillful.
So let's just see if between us we can think of some skillful responses in that scenario, bearing in mind your point that you don't want to go down a spiral of feeling worthless, yeah, or feeling that you're you've got no that you're disempowered in that scenario. Yeah. So yes.
I was going to say something and then I realised. What I was going to say, yeah, potentially could leave you feeling a bit like that, but I don't know, I think that we do have a tendency to always feel that we've been hurt and not really see the dynamic between us and the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I don't know, this is something that helps me on a practical level, is to think of it as a dynamic rather than that person's bad, I'm good, but that dynamic didn't work.
Yeah.
No value judgments, it just doesn't fit like a square peg in a round hole in a certain situation. How can that be fixed? And yeah, just approaching a situation with love, I think really, really does help.
Mm.
It's so hard.
Mm. Yeah, it's very, very hard.
But yeah, I could, as lots of sales.
Yeah, there's lots.
Like a key topic.
Yeah, it's a key topic. I think that's interesting though that you say that, particularly in a relationship context, there usually is a dynamic. And one of the things that, if we can start to understand that dynamic, what it can do is reduce the polarization of, as you say, I'm bad, or he's bad, or she's bad, and I'm good. It can start to reduce that polarization, just understanding what happens when these two individuals meet and their consciousness comes into contact with each other. What is my part in that? What's their part in that? That's one way of approaching this, which is to understand the situation in a broader context.
Can you just add something to that? Sorry,
yeah.
In a specific situation I was in,
yeah,
there was two of us who experienced the behaviour of someone,
yeah,
who I previously thought, oh, that person's completely in the wrong.
Yeah.
And I was shocked that this person
the other person
away.
Yeah.
And the other person was like, yeah, that was bad, but whatever.
Right.
And it showed me that it was a dynamic between me and this person that
right.
didn't work.
Right.
The person didn't react in that
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
And we rarely have that where we have another person in it who would react a different way,
yeah.
so we don't see our role in it.
Yeah. It's quite sort of annoying when that happens, doesn't it? When another person, you know, you're convinced that this person X is really out of order. I mean, they're outrageous in their behaviour, and then a friend of yours thinks, well, they're not so bad, you know. Of course, they're awful. So yes, that's it can reveal that we're not dealing in the realm of objective reality here. Yeah, we are involved in seeing the situation or the person from our side, from our perspective, and that will colour not only our view of them, but probably how they then relate back to us. Yeah, Nadia. Yeah.
I try and continue to show compassion to them.
Try and continue to show. So how would you do that?
I would try and show some care.
Yeah.
In some way.
Yeah.
Food.
Yeah. Yeah. Food works. Yeah. Yeah. So I think what you're saying, I mean, of course, in much more serious scenarios, you might not be able to do that. In a less serious scenario, you might be able to offer some sort of friendliness, generosity, kindness. That can help. It can soften the situation. Sorry, I'll say a few more things and then see if we've got time. That can be possible in a dynamic which hasn't gone too far wrong. Sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes it might even be dangerous. Yeah, if the other person is genuinely dangerous to our health and well-being, our physical. You don't then want to offer food. You've got to get out of the way. You've got to get out of the way. Never. So you can't. What I'm saying is that you've got to be intelligent about this. It's not like there's a blanket recipe for behaving that is always appropriate. You've got to be intelligent about this. Nevertheless, I think there are some sort of universals here. From one of the key kind of aspects that Buddhism teaches is that it's not just that my mind is like Vajrasattva in its purity, in its essence. All minds are Vajrasattva in their purity, in their essence, ultimately. And all of us who are unenlightened have clouded our minds in some way or another. And what as a Buddhist you're trying to do is not be naive about other people's unskillful behavior. You don't just kind of write it off and say, oh, they're fine. At the same time, you don't write them off and say that they're bad. You try and bear in mind their potential, which is your potential, which is enlightenment. Because any living being has that potential. That means they have a potential to change. And so from a Dharmic perspective, you never write somebody off as beyond change, as beyond the pale. So then that means other consequences can follow. That means that if they can change, you can start to look at what are the conditions that they need in order to change. Now, you might not be able to help them directly, but you can start to see them in a bigger context of they're stuck in a particular way of behaving. There is the potential of change. What would they need to change? Yeah, that starts to already see them in a more understanding light, in a light that sees them as part of their behavior as part of a broader set of conditions. If you can start to do that, this polarization that we get into, that they're awful and I'm a victim, starts to soften. Yeah, we're all in a way victims in a certain sense, although I don't like to use that language. We're all unenlightened and we're all suffering and we all want to be happy. And some people go about trying to be happy in ways that are really damaging to themselves and other people. Yeah, but Buddhism sees that as acting out of ignorance. We're all acting out of degrees of ignorance. So you never write somebody off, or you try not to. Now, that doesn't mean that you might not be intelligent about how you approach them, but you don't write them off as a human being. In the Metta Bhavana, in that fourth stage, we still try and cultivate well-wishing towards even the enemy, based on the fact that they too have the potential for change. And somewhere deep down we know that, actually, that human beings can change. It's a much more positive vision of life. Now, if that then brings you to the point where you can forgive, nobody can force forgiveness, but if it can bring you to the point where you can forgive, and that forgiveness normally includes forgiving ourselves for our part in the dynamic, if there is a dynamic. Now, of course, if it's a stranger that's done you harm, you know, that then it's not so much a dynamic. But if it's somebody that you've been in relationship with, there probably is your side of things too. And so forgiveness includes forgiving ourselves for not being perfect, for not always being able to be that wise, compassionate Buddha that we'd like to be. So it involves forgiving ourselves. And if we can realize that we too are flawed, we might become closer to forgiving somebody else. Again, you do that intelligently. Yeah, if somebody's, risking hurt, you don't do that lightly. But forgiveness is, in the end, a way to freedom. Because as long as we haven't fully forgiven the hurt, we remain trapped by the dynamic and by our identity as somebody who's been hurt. Now, that might be a necessary phase to go through. You know, forgiveness doesn't come all in one go and easily. But ultimately, it leads to freedom. And before this class, I was reading some stories of forgiveness. And you do read very inspiring stories. I was particularly reading some stories of parents whose children have been murdered, and who, you know, a mother who lost her son and was able to forgive the murderer and even argue for a reduced sentence for that person. Now that to me, I haven't got kids, but I can barely imagine the pain that that mother must have gone through. So for me, that shows the power of the human spirit. If somebody can do that, if somebody can rise above the pain to forgive. And in the end, what happens also is that you free yourself from, it's a way to freedom. So Bhadramati refers to it as a spiritual death practice. What she's talking about, forgiveness, that is, as a spiritual death practice, what she's talking about is that if we can forgive, and sometimes there's no reason to forgive, there's been real harm and hurt done, and rationally there'd be no reason. If we can forgive unconditionally, it's going beyond a sense of who we are as a limited identity. It's first of all going beyond ourselves as an identity that's just a victim identity. It's going beyond ourselves as somebody who has no power in the situation. It's going beyond ourselves as somebody who is always got to be in relationship to this awful event or this awful person. It's a way to freedom. And the old identity dies, and a bigger identity is born as somebody who's bigger than the situation. And that bigness points to the vastness that I was talking about. Vajrasattva's consciousness, or the consciousness that Vajrasattva represents, which is our own potential consciousness, is infinite. Yeah, it's so vast that there's no way of putting any shape to it. There's no identity there at all. There is just vastness. That vastness isn't just a cold, cool awareness. It's full of love. It's this vast, infinite ocean of love that is the nature of consciousness. That where even the notion of forgiveness doesn't really enter into it. There is just this unconditional love, because you recognize the potential for all beings. And because there's no separate notion of me as a separate person, there's no sense that I can be hurt. It's a completely different paradigm. It's a completely different way of experiencing the world. It's one that I can't say I live in. I might have glimpsed, but I can't say that I'm living in it. And at the same time, I know it's true. I know that it's possible, and I know that it's true. And the image of Vajrasattva points to that truth. It's a profoundly positive vision of life, of what human life is, what all life is. And anything that falls short of that vision is, we're being sold some sort of delusion. So when you think about what are you doing with your life, what I'm urging you to do is think about orientating your life towards this vision of consciousness that is possible. Everything in your life can be oriented towards that. If you're not orientating your life towards that transcendent vision, you're probably orientating your life towards some other vision of happiness. And, you know, like material success or finding the perfect partner that will give you enduring love. All of those other visions of happiness, and we could rattle them off probably if we had time, all of those fall short. They fall short, and unfortunately they let us down, because they're based on delusion. They will let us down. So Buddhism's saying, look, wake up to what's of real truth and real value, and start orientating your life towards that. Now, it's an ideal that can feel impossibly vast and high and unreachable, never mind the end point, even moving along the journey of developing a bigger self, a bigger consciousness, is worthwhile. If you really want fulfillment in your life, you have to look at how do you live to create this bigger consciousness, this purer mind. And ethics is where it starts from. And as I say, that's also where the journey ends, because ultimately there's the potential for being a transcendent force for good in the world. That's not to say that you can't be good in the world and help in the world before enlightenment. Of course you have to try. But enlightened compassion, enlightened wisdom, is of another dimension altogether. And that's what we're trying to channel. That's what we're trying to open up to. That's what Vajrasattva truly symbolises. So we'll leave it there. Thank you.